listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Opening Act by Britt Hennemuth, with opening photo by Luke Guilford. Clothing by Givenchy, rings by Repossi. True Blue, Charlotte Lawrence delivers an edgy pop sound steeped in California cool. Raised on sitcoms and surfing, Charlotte Lawrence grew up listening to the sounds of Hollywood. Now the 19-year-old singer writes her own music, eschewing teen pop confection for emotionally raw songs. After her 2018 hit EP Young, she plans to debut her first full-length album this year and contributes to the soundtracks for Birds of Prey, the latest film in the DC Comics universe, and the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why. Here, some insights gleaned from a day on the ski slopes with a bold new voice. She was raised between the L.A. enclaves of Brentwood and Malibu by TV titan parents, Scrubs creator Bill Lawrence and actor Krista Miller. Her mom hosted Sunday jam sessions for the family's Grammy-winning Friends. At 13, I played for my music idols and worked hard until I was confident that this wasn't just a hobby. She insists she was a very shy child. I'm still not good with speaking about real, emotional, darker stuff. I like to box that up for my music. She reveals she's in love, but is no longer dating fellow musician Charlie Puth, who produced some of her songs. I never regret any of my ex-boyfriends. He opened my eyes to a whole different side of music. She will tour with Love this summer and is particularly excited to perform at Red Rocks Park and Amphitheater in Colorado. It's my dream venue for the acoustics. She collects vintage band t-shirts and keeps them in little mini closets everywhere, from duffel bags in her car to storage units. Her style icons are Jonah Hill and Shia LaBeouf. A former model, she remains friends with Kendall Jenner and Kaia Gerber, whom she calls my sister until I die. She searches for meaning in modern chaos with God Must Be Doing Cocaine, her provocative single. I find a higher power in a lot of things, a sunset, how a song flows out of me. But we're not doing the best with our world. And if he's not helping us, he must just be doing drugs, she says. It's blasphemous, but I didn't want to speak for anybody but myself. The Hive Report from Nick Bilton. Dispatch from Silicon Valley. After Facebook went public, its first 250 employees started a secret message board called TNR 250, the Nouveau Riche, where they swapped links to potential post-stock sale purchases. Since then, dozens of other startup cash-outs have narrowed their wish list to a handful of Instagram-worthy commodities. Gulfstream G650ER for a private jet or PJ, the G650ER is modestly priced at a mere $66.5 million, and a range of 7,500 miles still gets you across the Pacific after a hard day of coding. The world's oldest sourdough starter, Silicon Valley nerds value the challenges of bread baking. The older your starter, the rumored record is 4,500 years, the higher you sit in the pecking order of cool. Third, fourth, and fifth homes. Owning two homes? No big deal. Owning two homes in the same city? Now that's baller. For privacy, buy up a neighborhood a la Mark Zuckerberg. Art. Sort of. While techies go a mile deep and an inch wide when it comes to their business, they tend to skimp on culture. As such, Banksy is their artist of choice.
Thank you.
On to My Place by Keziah Weir. Urban Oasis. Rem Koolhaas finds wonder in the textures of Doha, with illustrations by Cassandra Montoreal. It's rare, says Dutch architect Rem Koolhaas, that the complete repertoire of a modern city emerges more or less at the same time. Doha is an exception. After the Brits emancipated Qatar in 1971, the capital city was razed and rebuilt. Koolhaas first visited in 2006 and fell for the city's natural beauty, as well as its focus on art and innovation, before eventually designing the National Library. This month, Koolhaas mounts Countryside, the Future, a joint exhibition at New York's Guggenheim with Studio AMO. The project explores non-urban spaces and features Doha's entirely indoor dairy farm, created during Saudi Arabia's blockade of 2018. As Koolhaas calls it, instant countryside. In the photos and illustrations, the desert is very beautiful, three-dimensional with lots of dunes. The astounding and experimental National Museum, designed by Jean Nouvel. In the Koolhaas-designed National Library, you enter in the center and you're surrounded by a landscape of books. In a country of less than 3 million, the space had 1 million visitors in 2018 alone. Travel by bike, jeep, or the city's distinctive teal taxis. From Countryside, the Future. The chain Shatr Abbas is incredibly cheap, but unbelievably good food. From the very first moment, education was the absolute priority. This was instigated and maintained by the nonprofit Qatar Foundation. The Oceanside Shark Village and Spa, and a piece from Doha's Museum of Islamic Art.
Thank you.
Onto the Vanities, State of Arousal, Hot but Not Bothered. Yeah, baby. Powerful Women Are Horny and Proud by Rachel Dodds. It's 2020, and a tidal wave of anxiety is washing over us. To divert from his Senate impeachment trial, President Trump authorized the assassination of the second most powerful person in Iran, briefly leading our country to the brink of war. Australia caught fire, a casualty of a global climate crisis that our government continues to ignore. Facebook has responded to a seasonal surge in political propaganda, metastasizing on its platform by doing absolutely nothing. Harry and Meghan quit the firm, and drooling bloviator Rudy Giuliani has a podcast. Standing on the precipice of what is surely the apocalypse, women have decided it's high time to say the unsayable. In spite of everything, or maybe because of it, they're horny. Publicly identifying oneself as an aroused woman is having a moment. Call it the Hornissance. When Fleabag creator and star Phoebe Waller-Bridge hosted Saturday Night Live last fall, she observed in her opening monologue that back in the day, horny women were to be feared, and now they're given Emmys. Her series, centered on a depraved woman who frocked a priest in season 2, won 6 of them, proving once and for all that horniness trumps godliness. Waller-Bridge continued her streak as our horny emissary at the Golden Globes when she thanked President Obama for including Fleabag on his list of favorite TV shows, adding with a cocked brow, "As some of you may know, he's always been on mine." Fans of the show were in on the horny joke. In the pilot of Fleabag, the title character masturbates to Obama giving a speech on YouTube. In the opening photo, Marilyn Minter's Little Dipper, 2009. At the beginning of Jenny Slate's Netflix comedy special, Stage Fright, the comedian offers the following disclaimer: "So let me give you some good facts so that we can have an honest relationship. I'm horny." Allison P. Davis, a writer for New York Magazine, posted a smoldering photo of Prince on Twitter to announce her forthcoming book, Horny, in which she will explore what she referred to as one of the last great taboos. And the ultimate arbiter of sexual desire, Jennifer Lopez, recently told GQ magazine, "A lot of things make me horny." Who's allowed to be horny publicly says a lot about where we are as a society and where we are going. Men, for example, have always been presumed horny until proven otherwise. The term itself, most likely a reference to the shape of the phallus, was used exclusively to describe men and their sexual appetites for hundreds of years. It wasn't until sexologist William Masters and Virginia Johnson published Human Sexual Response in 1966 that female desire was identified as an actual scientific phenomenon that may possibly exist in the world. That doesn't mean it was celebrated. Who can forget the scandal that erupted 30 years ago when 2Live Crew released the hit song Me So Horny, featuring an audio clip uttered by a Vietnamese prostitute in Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket? 2Live Crew was charged with obscenity. Their album was banned in Florida, and the case eventually made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The idea of a horny woman was shocking and, at best, cringeworthy. Something to titter over as Mike Myers' Austin Powers posed his catch question, "Do I make you horny, baby?" The answer, at least on the part of audiences, was an unequivocal nope. Horniness was ridiculous, reserved for a fictional man of mystery with chest hair shaped like a penis. Not a calm and collected woman. There was a brief, anomalous period in the early aughts when it was approaching acceptable for women to talk about their horniness among friends, but it came to a grinding halt in February 2004 when two seemingly unrelated yet historically significant events took place within weeks of each other. Mark Zuckerberg launched Facebook, and Sex and the City went off the air. Over the course of the intervening years, the frank sex talk popularized by Carrie Bradshaw and her horny harem was driven underground, another casualty of tech. As we built up our public identities online, the performative nature of relationships on social media, look how perfect we are, had a suffocating effect on discussing our unmet sexual needs, IRL, without looking like a hypocrite. Technology cock-blocks horniness in more direct ways. You can't even post a photo containing a woman's nipple on Instagram without getting banned from the site. Facebook updated its community standards recently so that our universal symbols of horniness, the eggplant and peach emojis, are now verboten. The net effect has been to silo our horniness from the public sphere, surfacing only when people slide into each other's DMs or swipe right on hookup apps. Like everything else, horniness has been compartmentalized. Instead of bringing us joy, it brought us shame. So we con-maried it. Now, here we are, a little over a year after porn star turned national heroine Stormy Daniels crisscrossed the country on what she called the Make America Horny Again tour. It appears, against all odds, America is, in fact, horny again. And the horniness knows no bounds. It's as if horniness in 2020 has consciously uncoupled from sex. It's going to be weird explaining to our grandchildren how horny we all got about congressional hearings, tweeted television writer and podcast host Aaron Ryan. Supermodel Ashley Graham explained to late-night talk show host Lily Singh why she is horny for prayer. Lizzo is horny for K-pop, according to BuzzFeed, while Ariana Grande is horny for Christmas. In Apple TV's new original series Dickinson, dubbed Horny Emily Dickinson, Hailee Steinfeld's Emily is hot and bothered for death, embodied by Wiz Khalifa in a smoky CGI horse-drawn carriage. Other recent objects of declared female lust, podcast, grocery stores, specifically Wegmans and Trader Joe's, The Joker, and justice. Horniness has been applied to so many non-sexual activities that it is getting a little soft. And maybe that's the point. Today, being horny is about having a lust for life, in spite of all evidence that we should dig a hole and hide in a fallout shelter. It's about being an enthusiast and having hope in a time of confusion and upheaval. These public declarations on horniness are coming, yes, at a time when relations between men and women have never been more fraught. More than 2 years after the hashtag MeToo movement exposed a disgusting spectrum of sexual misconduct infecting practically every industry, a backlash is making it harder for women to succeed at work. Male executives in finance are reportedly ripping a page from the playbook of woman-fearing Vice President Mike Pence, resorting to de facto gender segregation to mitigate what they perceive as risky interactions. At the same time, men who have been credibly accused of sexual assault are sitting on the Supreme Court and in the White House. In her recent memoir entitled, What Do We Need Men For?, E. Jean Carroll describes a series of horrific incidents, including getting raped by Trump in a Bergdorf Goodman fitting room, and offers a Swiftian proposal, killing all the men, reducing them to their atomic elements, and selling them off for more worthwhile products, like Birkin bags. To be horny in 2020 is to be on the front lines of a rebellion. After all, the best way to win a debate is to acknowledge and embrace the worst thing that could be said about you. That's exactly why these horny and proud proclamations are important. They're a rallying cry to defang a culture of rampant misogyny. To declare one's horniness in 2020 is to perform a public service in a time when displays of female desire still remain risky for women. Just look at freshman Democratic Congresswoman Katie Hill, who resigned from the House of Representatives after nude photos of her were published on the Internet without her consent. Freelance writer and activist Leah McElrath was horny-shamed on Twitter after making a lusty comment about then-presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke that went viral. She later wrote that her identity as the author of the Beto sex tweet will likely end up on her tombstone. Even on television, it remains hard for women to own up to their horniness. In Mrs. Fletcher, the lead character, played by Katherine Hahn, holes up in her house to feverishly masturbate to porn. And in the first episode of Amazon's new series, Modern Love, based on the New York Times column of the same name, a young woman drafts a text to a new paramour to say she's feeling horny, then reconsiders, replacing horny with frisky. What a letdown! Because as we are discovering, horny women not only win Emmys, we shall inherit the earth. onto the fairground, the Golden Age. Diddy invited Vanity Fair into his Beverly Hills home to capture his 50th birthday bash with a special edition portrait studio. Photographs by Carlos Caito Araujo. In the photos, Sean Diddy Combs, Cardi B and Offset, Lizzo, Paris Hilton, Snoop Dogg, Mary J. Blige, Naomi Osaka, NYBN Cordae, Kanye West and Kim Kardashian West, Janelle Monáe, and Jaden Smith. Said Diddy, "I'm blessed to have made it to 50. Still more from the Vanities, conscious uncoupling, burning down the house. Does S-U-S-S-E-X spell disaster for a royal family in crisis? By Michelle Ruiz. Opening photo, the sparkliest royals are turning away from the firm, literally and emotionally. They said it wouldn't last. Are Prince Harry and Meghan doomed? New York wondered in the run-up to the couple's royal wedding in 2018. I think she will bolt, feminist writer Germaine Greer predicted on an Australian morning show of the then 36-year-old actor-activist bride. Not 2 years later, there is indeed a split underway, just not the one skeptics foretold. Prince Harry and Meghan Markle are still together. She's the same woman I fell in love with, he said in January, but they've effectively broken up with the 1,047-year-old monarchy. Queen Elizabeth II and company traffic in the presumption of magic and majesty, an assurance that divinely and by birth they are superior. Commoners are supposed to clamor at their gates, not marry in, and then make a U-turn for Canada. The monarchy already feels drearier without Harry and Meghan, who infused the whole operation with big celebrity energy. The Sussexes had an estimated 1.9 billion viewers in their thrall at their royal wedding. Harry bit his bearded lower lip and appeared to whisper, "You look amazing," in what became a much-memed moment. Meghan, the first biracial duchess in modern history, blinked back, glowing. The royal family was, but for a fleeting moment, both inclusive and sexy. This historically white and musty institution needed the couple to appear modern and relevant to survive into the 21st century. And January's shocking news, dropped via Instagram, struck a House of Windsor already in crisis. Last November, someone else had quit the firm when Prince Andrew relinquished royal duties for the foreseeable future amid allegations he was an abuser in Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking ring. The prince denies these allegations. In a disastrous BBC interview, the Duke of York minimized the late Epstein's alleged child sexual abuse as merely unbecoming. And before even that unpleasant PR nightmare disaster, there were the tabloid rumors swirling around Prince William, Kate, and their turnip toffs clique. It was only a year ago when 98-year-old Prince Philip tumped over in his Land Rover, and that seemed like the worst kind of news coming out of BP. The Queen conceded in her annual Christmas address that 2019 felt quite bumpy. Not since her self-described Annus Horribilis of 1992, when a fire broke out in Windsor Castle and three of her four children, Princes Charles and Andrew and Princess Anne, split from their spouses in high toe-sucking fashion, as the state of the royal union seemed so shaky. Eagle Eyes noticed that a photo of the Sussex family was absent from her desk. 2 weeks later, Harry and Meghan announced they were stepping down, and it's been nothing but tumult since. The monarchy ideally presents a cohesive front to the public, said royal historian Carolyn Harris, author of Raising Royalty, 1,000 Years of Royal Parenting. To her loyal subjects, the Queen is the pearl-decked personification of the state, and the crown is seen as a unifying force, a level of government that's above party politics. disharmony in the gilded British taxpayer-funded palaces defeats the purpose. But more than bad optics, some now worry that the loss of Harry and Meghan as working royals could leave the royal family short-staffed, especially after Prince Philip's retirement from public life in 2017, and diminish the monarchy's international reach. The Queen isn't just Queen of the United Kingdom, Harris notes. She reigns over 16 Commonwealth realms, including Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Jamaica, to which she and members of her extended family have embarked extensively on royal tours to flex their symbolic power. See Harry and Meghan getting laid on Bondi Beach in 2018. Wee Prince George greeting a bilby with William and Kate in Sydney in 2014. Fewer senior members of the family acting as brand ambassadors for the crown could lead to discord with, or worse, defections among the Commonwealth states. Australia held an unsuccessful constitutional referendum in 1999. Jamaica and Barbados have, at various times, considered replacing the Queen with a president. If the royal family is less visible in the Commonwealth realms in the next reign, Harris said, the question of the future of the monarchy in these 16 countries might arise. So much for the dream of the first biracial duchess in modern British history, ushering in a progressive new era. Instead, Meghan and Harry lasted just 19 months, a blip in a centuries-long reign. A gospel choir had heralded Stand By Me at their royal wedding. Perhaps never in Windsor Castle had an African-American preacher quoted Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and waxed poetic about the power of love. Assorted kings entombed therein may well have rolled over. But the belief that just by marrying Harry, Meghan could blow the mothballs off the monarchy, in the midst of a sharply divided post-Brexiting Britain teeming with nativism, may have been the biggest fairy tale of all. As far as I'm concerned, the monarchy really lost out, says Kaylee Nicole Gross, the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of History at Rutgers University, who specializes in black women's experiences in U.S. history. You push aside that pomp and circumstance, and what's underneath is not pretty. One might have guessed that Harry and Meghan would gradually drift into their own royal celebrity hybrid roles. He had a TV deal with Oprah. She designed a capsule fashion collection to benefit underserved women. They declined to give their son Archie a title, but the brevity of Harry and Meghan's time as senior royals begs the question, how inhospitable must the royal mantle be to a biracial, self-identified feminist and her rebel-hearted husband that they said goodbye so soon? The Irishman felt longer than Harry and Meg's tenure. I don't think it reflects well on the institution or its place in contemporary Britain, Effua Hirsch, the Booker Prize-winning author of British and Equal to Everything, told Vanity Fair. The big question, when this engagement and this marriage was announced, was whether a woman of color could thrive in the very specific context of the royal family. Harry's emotional statement that there really was no other option seems to provide a deflating answer. There was what Harry called a ruthless campaign of relentless propaganda against her by the British tabloids, and bald gestures like Princess Michael of Kent's blackamoor brooch. The royal family is ground zero for a history of white supremacy and imperialism that they've never acknowledged, let alone apologized for it, Hirsch said. Buckingham Palace's one-time silence on the press treatment of the Duchess of Sussex now feels like a missed opportunity to have protected the first biracial duchess it initially seemed so pleased to claim. It was only as the two sides jockeyed over the public narrative and attempted to iron out the terms of Meghan and Harry's exit that the Queen took corrective measures. In a warm statement amid the Sussexes' departure in January, Queen Elizabeth said she was particularly proud of how Meghan has so quickly become one of the family. But the show of solidarity may have been too little, too late. Now the remaining members of the royal family find themselves stuck in a toxic relationship with Britain, says Hirsch, submitting to vicious cycles of tabloid scrutiny in exchange for seasons of positive coverage. It's a codependency Prince Harry knows too well. For all the suggestion that Meghan masterminded the couple's relocation to North America, Harry's own reasons to seek a more untethered life have been mounting since the death of his mother, Princess Diana, in 1997. I've seen what happens when someone I love is commoditized to the point that they are no longer treated or seen as a real person, he said in a statement announcing a lawsuit against the Mail on Sunday last year. I lost my mother, and now I watch my wife falling victim to the same powerful forces. Diana never escaped the vicious cycle between the royals and the tabloids. Harry seems determined to try. To others, the saga will only make the monarchy even more relatable. Royal families, they're just like us, and in turn, beloved. Her Majesty's January statement, referring not to the monarchy, but to my family, is a parallel to 1997, when she spoke as a grandmother about Diana's death. Reminding the public that the Queen is also Gangan goes a long way to humanizing the institution. Just as she did in the wake of 1992, the Queen and the remaining senior working royals will carry on with public engagements as normal to make clear that the monarchy is not being paralyzed by any one disagreement, Harris said. As the Queen has said, I have to be seen to be believed. The royal family is only in danger, says Kehinde Andrews, a professor of black studies at Birmingham City University, when nobody cares. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.